This week, the Department of Corrections announced a new tikanga-based strategy, Hokairangi, aiming to reduce the Māori prison population to a more proportionate 16%. It's about 52% in men's prisons. Māori population very much higher in women's prisons, up to 60+, I think. This in the wake of a report from a hui in Rotorua, which said the justice system is at a crisis point, responsible for intergenerational racism, bias, abuse, and colonisation. Māori lawyer and youth advocate Kingi Snelgar is working in the system. He says it needs decolonising. I asked him what that means.
Decolonisation is the idea, stems from our history in New Zealand. And the idea for me is that courts and prisons have been one of the key institutions in colonisation. Māori have a lot of distrust for court systems, and prisons have been used as a way to basically remove generations of Māori from their families and their identity. So decolonisation is to undo the institutions and frameworks that have put in place removal of Māori from who they are. So how that looks in practice for me is returning the aspects of the justice system back to Māori to decide and run how offenders and how victims are dealt with.
Blimey, where would you start?
So sentencing has been an area that's already started. It's still within the main justice framework. So there are marae-based youth courts where young people go to the marae, talk to elders about what they've done and re-engage with their culture. So that's a small thing that has, I think there are about 15 marae-based youth courts around the country now.
Let's talk about that as it works in practice. You've been there, done that, right?
Yes.
What happens?
So the elders bring on a group. I come on with them on through a pōwhiri, and there is mihi, whai kōrero, and a whanaungatanga session where the young people introduce who they are, where they come from. Often they don't know their whakapapa, so their links to who they are. So there is some help by the elders to help that young person reconnect. Marae is a completely different environment to a court. And I've had young people go through this process and say to me afterwards, Kingi, why can't all courts be like this? There is aroha, there is manaaki, and the family are welcomed with open arms versus a court system, which is a very stale, very monocultural, very oppressive space.
How do they get the sense that they've done something wrong if everything's so loving?
Oh, it is. It's definitely loving, but there is...
As a Pākehā way, right? But,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a valid question. You do something wrong, you need to be made to feel bad about doing it. That's the theory about the prison system, isn't it, and the sentencing.
Yep, there's that idea of punishment, of making sure that person is held accountable. And definitely the elders talk about, the importance of being held accountable. They make sure that the victims' voices are heard, whether or not directly, but talk about how would you feel if this was your family member that had their car stolen, or if your family member was in a dairy where you went in and robbed it, how would you feel? So that is a key part of the youth court process, is to make sure the young person understands the impact of what they've done. But a lot of these people are very young, are still coming to grips with who they are. But obviously, yes, there is no, less weight put on victims and punishment. But we know that statistically.
And is there any punishment? Is there what are the consequences for these young people?
Yeah, we know that punishment as a primary way in our justice system doesn't really work. It's not effective. Making sure people understand the impact of what they've done is definitely important, so that they don't repeat that. But punishing people doesn't really teach them anything, but being held accountable in the youth court will be things like doing hours of community work, giving back to the community, giving a meaningful apology to the victim at a family group conference. Reflective pieces of art or poetry and speeches are also part of it to help the young person have a better insight. But, you know, you must also realise a lot of these young people that come through the youth court are extremely broken. They come from abusive families, from failed care and protection processes. So a lot of it is just reassuring them that they are worthy, that people love them. And so it's a balance between making sure they're held accountable, but also trying to make sure that they feel that they are loved and supported as part of our society.
A few years ago now, you were Crown Prosecutor in the case against two young boys, 12 and 13 at the time, who were charged with murder and manslaughter of Dario and Aaron Kumar.
Yes. Yeah.
You would have argued for their culpability. You would have argued for their punishment, presumably. Were you?
Yes.
Were you feeling turbulent in yourself about that position?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I was turbulent from the moment that I took that job and spoke to some of my mentors and thought, you know, being raised as a young Māori person, proud of who I am I doing the right thing by working in an institute, working for an office that incarcerates and punishes our people? That case in particular was really tough, yeah. You know, I obviously had a role to play in the justice system, and a lot of the, you know, family and friends would ask me, King, are you comfortable working as a prosecutor? And I thought, well, it's important to have people in that seat as well, because there are a lot of Māori victims of crime. So being able to relate to victims, you know, and make them comfortable, and also bring some humanity as a prosecutor as well. We have a lot of discretion in that role. So in that case, yeah, that was tough for me to see these two young boys who had had terrible upbringings. And that was the last case that I did before I went overseas.
Had you planned to go overseas, or did the case make you go overseas?
I had planned. I went overseas to do some study, but
was that on your Fulbright?
Yes, right. Yeah.
You went to Harvard.
Yes, but that was a tough case. That, you know, a lot of sleepless nights, and you know, even the work that I do at the moment does take a big toll as well.
That was. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But that was a terrible case, and this individual died as a result of being attacked by these two young boys. Can you tell me what happened to them?
So, yeah, there was a lot of suppression around the circumstances.
Yeah, but I know.
Essentially, the young boys, one was found guilty of manslaughter, and the other was found not guilty, so no criminal responsibility in that sense. The chief prosecutor, the main prosecutor, Kieran Raftery, is very experienced. He kind of foreshadowed to the family that it will be very difficult for this jury to convict this young person, only 13, of murder. But that was extremely difficult for me to be in a courtroom where the back room was filled with family members of these two young boys, but also the family of the deceased. And a lot of Māori people as well. So, yeah, it's part of my life that I found that quite a traumatic experience, but that kind of, I think, really encouraged me to look at the system, the wider system, and think, you know, for example, in those two boys' cases, they were care and protection young boys, and there were several issues that I saw with the way that they had come through the system.
So we're getting back to Oranga Tamariki at this point, aren't we?
Yes, and it is a difficult role to be a social worker, but, you know, I've seen through my experience as a youth advocate in the youth court that there are a lot of young people let down by Oranga Tamariki, either by intervening too much or by not intervening at all.
You know, the problem, I mean, I'm up against, I can see the brick wall in front of me here. It's my own brick wall. Help me through this. You've said that these two boys had a terrible upbringing. We're familiar with the story. Terrible upbringing. You go into care. You come out. You carry on the sins of your fathers and your mothers, right?
Mm, yes.
You're trying to break the cycle. But what is Oranga Tamariki to do if it comes upon a child who's in the middle of having a terrible upbringing? Mm. And there is no whānau to take over. It's all, they're all dysfunctional as a result, no doubt, of colonisation, but nevertheless, dysfunction is dysfunction. How do you break through that?
that's the magic question there.
That
colonial legacy, we need to remind ourselves that the situations that we have are not, we can't blame families and say, well, this is your dysfunction that has caused this situation.
The reason why they've... You don't have to accord blame.
No.
But dysfunction is dysfunction, right? And
yes.
If it's damaging a child, then you have to take the child out of it.
Yes, and the child and the mother is the key thing. Don't
what if the mother's dysfunctional?
Yes, and there's degrees of dysfunction, but still, there are examples that I'm aware of where I don't think social workers have dug deep enough to find other suitable placements within the family. And social workers are under-resourced, not supported enough in difficult positions. But what I would like to see is more partnerships between Oranga Tamariki or more power given to iwi to take over those functions and to help find safe homes.
So going back to these two young boys in the case in which you were Crown Prosecutor, against every instinct, if the justice system had been decolonised, what would have happened to them? I mean, we have to come into the story at some point, and we could go back earlier and say Oranga Tamariki or the SIFs should not have taken them into care. But nevertheless, here we are, we're in court, 12 and 13-year-old, charged with murder, manslaughter. How would you decolonise that process for them?
And that's hard to just pick that one trial and try to decolonise that process, because that's a very serious example of a crime and a very complex situation. But, you know, I would like to think that if we decolonise the entire justice system, that there would be less and less of those examples. And the problem is, I think, that people see murder, they see very serious rape cases in the media, and they think that that is how we should treat everyone, in the sense that punishment and safety are the primary factors. But we know that when people are released from prison, when people go to prison, the chances of them being released are very high. People don't go to prison for life. They go inside and they become, they learn how to become a better criminal, and then are released and often will reoffend. So that one trial, how to decolonise that process, that would be very difficult. But what I would like to see is less punishment in the entire system, and then maybe we won't see as many of these really terrible examples of crimes down track. We know that there are, I think, about 2% of those in prison are maximum risk, and over 50% of those in prison are low to minimal risk. So in the ideal world, we would have, you know, only prisons as an absolute last resort, and treat people for their the reason for why they go into prison in the first place, which we know is, and you know, around 90% of the time is because of some mental health issue or substance abuse.
I mean, this doesn't go into Māori, of course, but
no.
You know, I mean, you could argue that everybody who ends up in prison has some prior condition over which they had no control.
Yes, not just Māori, but Māori are disproportionately represented.
Indeed.
and are treated differently. But that, it's hard. The example that I'm trying to talk through, that murder case, you know, we know that the parents of both those young boys were, through the system themselves. And I would have liked to think that if we drew a line in the sand today and decided we need to make some transformative change right now, that in 2 to 3 generations we will see the benefit of that with less of these kind of cases that come before the court. So that's what I, you know, am passionate about, is about seeing the prisons at one stage becoming redundant and moving towards examples like we see in Norway, where they have open prisons where people are treated for why they got into trouble in the first place.
I'm talking to Auckland defence lawyer Kingi Snelgar. The Hui Māori report, among many recommendations and observations, said tikanga, mātauranga Māori and Māori worldviews are ways in which Māori approach wellness, health and well-being, and any justice system reform must balance all of these elements.
Hmm.
What does that mean?
So I think that means that we need to take into account the Māori worldview the Māori worldview in justice. At the moment, the system that we have doesn't really account for the Māori worldview.
What's the Māori worldview?
Well, the Māori worldview is that you are one part of a greater being, of a holistic being, that you are part of a family, that you have responsibilities to family, to the land. You know, in some ways, the justice system that we have treats you as an individual who's committed this crime in a two-page summary of facts, and that you need to be removed from your situation for the safety of the community. So that's kind of against the Māori worldview, that you are part of this wider network. And often, you know, from a Māori point of view, if you commit a crime or a hara or a wrong, it's not only you that's responsible, it's the wider community as well. So that's the key difference I see is putting more emphasis on community and as a way to hold that person accountable, but also as a way to make sure that they don't repeat their behaviour.
Does that Māori worldview remain valid for, you know, third generation Māori who have been deracinated, they've been urbanised, they don't know, as you said earlier, they may not know their whakapapa at all. Does that Māori view resonate with them at all?
I think I've seen this through the Marae Court at the youth court, that there are a lot of young Māori who don't know their language, won't know their whakapapa, but when they come into a marae, they feel that connection, that spiritual connection. They see value in those worldviews, and even though they might not appreciate all the intricacies and the tikanga intrinsically, they have a connection. And so that's an important part of the court system, and even though I have issues with using a court system to, you know, reconnect people with culture, that's a really massive part of court, is helping that person realise that they have mana, they are part of this wider network, they're not alone in the world. So I do think, even though they might not know it, it is within them, it's within their blood as a Māori person.
You need to indoctrinate's the wrong word, but it's kind of a massive education process to reconnect a lot of these young people and older people with the kind of world that you want them to inhabit.
Yes. And there are there's this group, you know, that see courts as their marae, as their community spaces.
Well, you said that they feel more comfortable in prisons or court than they do in the marae.
Yeah, it's really sad. And as I said, that's the colonial legacy that we have of you know, state care abuse, removing children from whānau, and we are where we are today, where we have pretty much across every single government agency saying we are at a crisis point with Māori, and we need to return power back to Māori to take care of these issues.
Do you think that we've hit some kind of tipping point at the moment?
Yes, I do. It's been, these issues around the justice system have been around for years.
For sure.
Since Mauna Jackson wrote his report in 1988. And I do think we are in a climate now where we have a minister, Andrew Little, who has, you know, maybe not as concerned about public perception as the previous government.
Well, I mean, Bill English said that prisons were a moral failure.
Yes.
So, you know, everybody's heart is in that place. There are very few people who would ever admit that prisons work. They just can't. It seems such an ask to come up with an alternative system.
Yes, it's difficult, but we do have examples. There are examples in New Zealand. There's drug courts already in place. There's countries in, you know, like Norway and Finland, who had a similar crime rate to us and have drastically reduced their prison population through rehabilitation. So we aren't stabbing in the dark, so to speak. We do have examples. The problem, I think, is the wider perception within New Zealand society that we have this huge crime issue that requires people to be locked up, and we, you know, that's the main thing I think we need to change is that public perception of punishment as a way that helps, that works, and it clearly doesn't.
The Ombudsman's report into Ngā Whā Prison came out this week. Ngā Whā Prison in Northland, it was supposed to be a flagship for the integration of prison with Māori. It was set up to work as the government's new strategy imagines. It was set up for local people to go to. They could get visits from their family because it was local rehabilitation Māori elders. Complete failure, according to the Ombudsman's report. There was no tikanga Māori there. The relationship broke down between, it seems, everybody, corrections and iwi. And Mana Whenua was nowhere in sight. That's a signal failure of something that would appear to be designed according to what you would like to see, surely.
Yeah, I need to be a bit careful there. My uncle worked at Ngā Whaia, teaching tikanga to some of the inmates. So if you're listening, Uncle, kia ora. But no, absolutely. The issue that I see, though, is that we are trying to put tikanga Māori within a prison system. And that is, to me, the total opposite. They're two polar opposites. A prison is something that isolates people.
So what the government came up with this week, it's Hoka Rangi strategy, is doomed to failure, is it? Because it's something that corrections will be in charge of.
Yes, I think it's a good step, but we know that corrections is the final part in the justice system. There is police, there are courts that have huge amounts of discretion. So if we're only fixing the final piece of the puzzle, the correction process or having these great aims, it's not going to work unless there's that wider transformation. But fundamentally, I have concerns about, still relying on prisons and tikanga in prisons as a way to create change and to reduce recidivism. To me, using a prison as a starting point is not going to do that.
No. I mean, this is the trouble politically, isn't it? Baby steps is usually the way to affect change politically. We'll do this, and then we'll do that, and then we'll do this, and then, lo and behold, we're there. But you're saying baby steps won't work, because unless you do a complete revolution of the system, you're always going to be left with bits that are going to drag it back down again.
Exactly, and we know prison's the final step in the system, that there needs to be this wider public education on justice as a crisis in New Zealand, and that unless we make drastic changes, we're going to keep spending billions and millions of dollars on a broken system that doesn't keep us safer, doesn't help people, and ultimately is bad for New Zealand. You know, I do congratulate the writers of these reports, but, you know, I'm a sceptic on corrections being able to change those rates for Māori from 52% to 16%. We know that unless police change, unless the court system changes, that it's unrealistic.
Is there anywhere in the world where the Indigenous people have been given anything like the power to rule themselves in terms of the justice system that you're recommending?
So I worked in America for a native court there, and I visited a couple other native court systems. So they have their own reservations or nations where they have autonomous court systems. The problems in some of those places were that the courts were imposed on that reservation, and that they were still quite Pākehā Western in the way that they were run. But I have seen an example in the Onondaga Nation. It's a place in New York that's been able to keep their system of governance going for about 10,000 years, and they don't accept any money from the government. The way that they deal with crime is by bringing people into their meeting houses and talking through the issue. So, that's an extreme example, I guess. But
what if a non-native person is involved in the crime? Does it still go back to them?
No, I think that in that situation, and if it's a very serious crime, the FBI steps in. But this was more for the more minor offending. We do already have justice panels on marae that are dealing with, minor things, especially things like suspended licences and so forth. But, I would like to see greater power being given back to communities rather than courts to, help the people that are coming into contact with the crime. I see when I walk into the court, it's obvious that poverty is a huge issue. We should have a wraparound service in the courts that's there to help address what's going on in this person's life for why they've got into trouble with the law.
Yeah, and I mean, that's likely to happen like never, isn't it? Because it's so complicated.
Yes, and I don't think that should stop us from having these. I guess it's not really a dream, but these ideas about what we should have as a system. It's more cost effective as well. We know prisons cost around $100,000 per year to keep someone in prison. If we want to be more cost effective, we need to treat the underlying causes for why people get into trouble. Putting people in prison just because they don't have a suitable address for their home detention, or they're are committing crime because they're addicted to methamphetamine, that's not going to change the underlying issues. So we are quite short-sighted in our justice system. There are people that are trying to make change within the different areas. There are judges that are being proactive. But like you said earlier, unless there's that wider transformative change, the way that people like Moana Jackson have been advocating for 30 years, then we are just going to keep flogging a dead horse.
Transformative seems scary to a lot of people, though, doesn't it? Because it's so big that if it goes wrong, if it doesn't go quite right, the chances of fallout are very high, both politically yes. and actually socially.
Yes, and there are already huge fallouts at the moment.
I know, but people always prefer the status quo to to the great unknown when it comes to this kind of thing, don't they?
Yes, and I think if we just keep using the examples of Finland, of Norway, where they have managed to turn it around. Of course,
you haven't mentioned Portugal, and I know you have mentioned Portugal in the past, decriminalising drugs for personal use.
Mm.
That's part of the story in Portugal. Are you putting that into your story here?
I would like to see that as well, yes. If personal use drugs, treating that as a crime is, I don't see the benefit in that. If people are addicted to drugs, why don't we treat the addiction? I can't see how giving them a fine or putting them in jail is going to change that addiction. So that's another step along the path. But I feel sometimes in New Zealand that we're quite narrow-minded. We are quite isolated physically from the rest of the world, and I wonder sometimes if that makes us too comfortable in our ways. And that's what I experienced travelling overseas, was a lot of people saw the Māori worldview as beneficial. And coming home, I've just noticed that we are, like you say, a bit reluctant to try new things. But I'm certainly not going to give up. I don't want to be working as a defence lawyer in this system forever. I couldn't sustain it, and I would like to see big changes that's good for the whole of New Zealand.
I would have thought a defence lawyer clearly would be better for your soul than being a Crown Prosecutor. What's the hardest thing for you right now?
The stories, dealing with children who come from broken families, dealing with young people in the youth court that have been abused as a child. Sometimes that abuse would have occurred in care. Dealing with clients that have had no one tell them that I believe in you, you can do this. Being Māori, I think it takes more of a toll on me in terms of the spiritual side. So, it's a different kind of angst or worry or hurt or responsibility. And then there are just so many people in need that are calling, ringing for Māori lawyers. Can you please help my son? Can you please help my cousin? And I'm only one person. I work in a chambers with other Māori lawyers, but we're all pretty flat out because the need is so high.
But in fact, you wouldn't want more Māori lawyers to join the system. You want to decolonise the system.
Yes.
You want to change the system entirely.
Oh yeah, my goal would be to have a system where I don't need to work in the as a defence lawyer in the sense that I am right now. Certainly, things like the Marae Court and drug courts are spaces that are therapeutic and beneficial.
Is there any evidence that they work? How would you measure their working?
So the rate of recidivism, the rate that they come back to court for offending, the drug courts, the two pilots in Auckland and Waitakere have had promising results in terms of reducing recidivism. So that's the key indicator, that are people coming back to prison and reoffending. And in Norway,
over what period has that been measured here?
I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but I do know, and I don't know if they've got a full report done because the pilot hasn't been running for that long. But I do know that, say, for example, in Norway and Finland, they have the lowest rates of recidivism in the world compared to New Zealand, where if you're half the people that are let out of prison go back to prison within 2 years. So if we use Norway as a benchmark, we are 30% behind them in terms of recidivism. And how they've managed to do that is by treating more the issues that the person faces, by keeping more people in the community. Because statistically, if you go to prison, you're more likely to reoffend versus someone who remains in the community. So that's the key indicator for me, is how, if this person is dealt with by the justice system, how often are they coming back as a repeat customer? And in New Zealand, it's half the time within 2 years, which is, you know, as a measurement, that's pretty shocking.
Racism is a word that gets levelled a lot at the systems and the people who run the systems, the prison system, the court system, the police. Do you call it racism, or do you call it unconscious bias, and is there a difference?
So it's both. Racism is more conscious appreciation of what's happening. So there can be racism in the sense that we know about the issues in the system, the disproportionate impact on Māori, and we don't do anything about it. To me, that's racist. We don't try change it. Unconscious bias would be that everyday person at the front line, that police officer, we know that they unconsciously are more likely to stop a Māori person, are more likely to charge them, more likely to deny them bail, and then when they go before a judge, they're treated differently. That's been acknowledged by the police. They've said that there is that unconscious bias. But racism is more the structural...
Just let's pause there for a moment, because here's the thing. You mentioned this issue earlier. If you want to give bail to somebody, they need to have a residence. But if you're very poor, well, A, you might not get bail. B, you might not have a permanent residence. So you are handicapped by those facts. That's not necessarily either unconscious bias or racism. It's the way it is, isn't it?
Sometimes, yes, sometimes. Sometimes, though, if you're a Māori and you have the same, you know, this is just the statistics, though. In terms of the way that you're treated, you'd still be treated differently, even if you had a bail address. We know that most Māori will have issues with things like overcrowding, or there are policies on Housing New Zealand houses. No, you can't get bail there because Housing New Zealand says you can only have four people living there. And Māori are, you know, more often living in those kind of situations than non-Māori. Mm. So there are different treatments for Māori in the justice system. But the racism point is more the institutional racism. The institution as a whole treats Māori differently. And if we are consciously appreciate that, and we can allow it to continue, then as a society, you know, I think we need to take responsibility.
I mean, in this democracy, Māori will always be a minority. So the decolonising project is doomed to failure unless you can get a significant proportion of non-Māori on your side. Is that the plan? Is that what you think could happen?
Yes, there's the treaty as well, the treaty partnership that exists between Māori and the Crown. So within the democratic process, it's always going to be difficult within government to make change because, like you say, we're a minority, we only have a few seats. We need to convince some of our other Pākehā colleagues to create that change. But if there's enough pressure on something, like what we're seeing with the Hūmātau, there are other ways to create a climate for change besides just the political numbers. And I think with the kind of kōrero that we're seeing in the media now about the justice system being broken, I'm hopeful to see a lot more non-Māori realise that this is a moral and fiscal failure, which is what the chief science advisors said, the Prime Minister's chief scientific advisor. This is a moral and fiscal failure, so let's do something about it.
I'm talking to Auckland Defence Lawyer Kingi Snelgar. You've spoken about your Te Puna Moko Moko, your great-great-great-great-grandfather, and what happened to him. Does that inform you, or have you only discovered this later in life? Were you brought up knowing this? What happened?
My nana told me a little bit about it, but that tupuna who was hung at Mount Eden for a crime he didn't commit in the 1800s. I've kind of, since becoming a prosecutor and a defence lawyer, looked more into that history. And it certainly, I feel a strong affiliation with him and his legacy.
And others were charged with the murder of the Reverend Carl Vaughner.
That's right, yes. Moko Moko had that famous phrase that he said in 1866 when he was just about to be put to death. And he's been pardoned, since that date.
2011, I think, yeah.
Yeah, Tanguhia te taura I taku kaki kia waiata I taku waiata, which means remove the noose from my neck so that I might sing my song. And that metaphor for removing, these constrictive and dehumanising punishment-focused institutions is what kind of I live for today.
Is it with you, that thing? I mean, that's a huge thing.
Yes, and he's an ancestor that I'm from Whangarei. I was born and raised there, but he's from Opotiki. I've only been to visit the marae a couple times, but every time I get onto the motorway and go past Mount Eden Prison, I think about him. Every time that, that I need some inspiration for what I'm doing and question my if what I'm doing is right, I think about him and his legacy. It's a huge part of what I'm doing.
You mentioned your time in the United States and North America earlier, where you did your master's at Harvard, and you were also a human rights observer at the Standing Rock in North Dakota, where the people were protesting the pipeline. What did you observe there? How does what happened there inform how you see things here?
There were a few things about that Standing Rock experience. One of the main things was the benefit of direct action to raise issues for Indigenous peoples. Like you said, we're a minority, same as the Native Americans in the States. They are a much smaller minority. And so when they don't have success through politics or through court, the way that we can create change is through direct action. So that was a community-led action to try stop that pipeline, which was halted for a while until Trump got into power. But that formula or that idea of direct action is something we know as Māori in New Zealand through things like our hikoi for the land march, the foreshore and seabed issue, the language, and most recently at Ehu Mātau around land protection.
The trouble with direct action is, I mean, if you're wanting to win the hearts and minds of the people who aren't on your side right now, direct action is unlikely to do that, right?
It depends on the way that it happens. A lot of Indigenous people use passive or peaceful resistance. And that formula, from Parihaka in our history, it's been something that we look to. And I think that a lot of non-Māori have seen the issues at Ehu Mātau, for example, and thought, actually, I support that. That one small block of land that's left for that people, that's a really sad legacy. The Indigenous way that I've seen is passive and peaceful resistance, and that certainly was what was at Ehu Mātau and Standing Rock.
Ehu Mātau has proven to be a really wicked problem for everyone involved. Do you have any suggestions as to how it could be resolved?
I would be hesitant to say this is what should happen as someone who isn't from that area. But what I do think is that it is a good thing that we are bringing attention to the issue about private land in New Zealand and these kind of really special places where the land was confiscated, and there are big developments happening that will really hurt the local people, that we are seeing attention going to these kind of issues.
Large amounts of government money in order to solve it, it seems large amounts of government money are going to be handed out because, yes, the land was confiscated and then it was handed on, then it was handed on, and then it was bought. And the person who bought it, presumably, I mean, this is a rough description, the person who bought it thinks that they pay good money, and why should they be embroiled in some kind of ownership crisis now? Do you know what I mean? So yep. Somebody's going to have to be paid out along the way.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And that's only fair. And it's also fair to acknowledge that legacy of colonisation within land issues. I know that's a very sensitive issue for us as New Zealanders. We have our, you know, our patch of land. That's our pride and joy. But, you know, I don't think you should be scared about Māori coming in and taking your house. It's more around these really special places. And this has been, the private land ownership issue has been quite a big issue with treaty negotiations. It's been off the table. So I think what Hui Mātou is telling us is that the treaty is not going away. Settlement does not mean the end of the treaty relationship. And there will be these kind of examples that will continue.
Mm. What else did you learn at Standing Rock? Do you ever think that New Zealand is better or worse off than other places?
Yeah, different. You know, I don't think it's kind of weird to say, oh, we've had a better run of colonisation than another place.
We get a bit smug, you know, saying, wow, we've got the treaty and look at those poor Aboriginals. And
yeah.
So you think that that's unnecessarily complacent?
Yes, a little bit. That's something that my friends over there would say, well, Māori have got it good, haven't they? It's really great. And I said, actually, no, I disagree. And there are actually lessons we can learn here about how you are running your own prison system or justice system, not really a prison system. You've managed to govern yourselves and have your own schooling and so forth. So there is this perception around the world that Māori have it all together, and we certainly have been lucky with the language in some ways. But, you know, I don't want to be complacent because I think there are some really big issues over the horizon coming.
Are you going to carry on being a barrister, a defence lawyer?
I don't think I can forever. I think I'll run out of steam because, you know, I do get quite affected by working in a broken system, but there are people that need my help.
It's a tricky decision to make, isn't it?
Yes, it's something that a lot of Māori young professionals need to grapple with, is that decision to work and learn how to be to work within a system as a defence lawyer, work in government, but also to bring your skills home to benefit your marae, your people. So eventually I'd like to move back to Whangarei and do more surfing and spend more time with my partner and baby that's going to be born in October. So, but no, I don't think the justice system is where I want to be forever.
What could you more fruitfully do? Pending the decolonisation.
I think that I would like to see more strategic work from both government and iwi around how would you design a system like you've talked about. We're saying decolonisation, well, what's the framework? How is this going to work within the next 5 to 10 years? So that might be something that, you know, I'm interested in, is that whether it's consulting or advising hapu and iwi or government around these systems and how it would practically work. We know with Oranga Tamariki there are already provisions in the law for giving back some services to hapu and iwi. So that's a really exciting area, is to help with that slow incremental change, but also, you know, to keep doing things like this to encourage people to think about the bigger transformative changes that are going to happen in our country.
And that was Kingi Snelgar, lawyer, barrister and youth advocate.